engineers. I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.
Today is Monday, December the 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. President Joe Biden says defeating the coronavirus pandemic, both at home and around the world, is his top priority.
And the United States is leading the world on vaccination donations. We need, as we're doing that, we need other high-income countries to deliver on their own ambitious vaccine donations and pledges. That's why today we're launching the EU-US Vaccine Partnership.
And marking International Migrants Day, the United Nations reports that hostility and xenophobia are growing against migrants. And President Emmanuel Macron has cancelled his trip to Mali.
The official reason for him cancelling that is because of the COVID emergency in France. Plus, he thought it would be irresponsible to mingle with French troops in Gao if he was coming directly from France, where there is this, an increase in the number of COVID cases.
That is Catherine Field in Paris. And Aboriginal groups have criticized a new law intended to protect cultural heritage in Western Australia. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin says he can't vote for his party's $2 trillion spending bill as the White House accuses him of breaking commitments. AP's correspondent Julie Walker has more.
Manchin's opposition puts it all on hold indefinitely, seemingly dealing a fatal blow to President Biden's domestic initiative heading into an election year when Democrats' narrow hold on Congress was already in peril.
I cannot vote to continue with this piece of legislation. I just can't. I've tried everything humanly possible. I can't get there.
The White House calls his opposition sudden and inexplicable. The West Virginia senator cites a multitude of factors: inflation, debt, COVID variants.
This is a mammoth piece of legislation, and I had my reservations from the beginning.
Manchin made his comments on Fox News Sunday. I'm Julie Walker.
And U.S. President Joe Biden says defeating the coronavirus pandemic, both at home and around the world, is his top priority. VOA looks at how he handled this unprecedented global and domestic challenge during his first year as president with this report from White House correspondent Anita Powell.
President Joe Biden's early days in office were marked by a grim victory for the virus. In the first week of his term, the U.S. reached 25 million cases of COVID-19, continuing the country's dubious distinction as leading in global cases and deaths. In February, the U.S. hit 500,000 COVID-19 deaths. In April, the world hit 5 million deaths. And then, just as Americans began to vaccinate en masse, and much of the world was still waiting, the highly infectious Delta variant hit. Biden has had to balance his responsibility to his citizenry with what he says is a moral obligation of the world's wealthiest nation to the rest of the planet. In June, more than 6 months after Americans began receiving their vaccinations, the U.S. began sending out millions of vaccine donations to lower and lower middle-income nations. By September, Biden described the U.S. as the world's arsenal of vaccines, with pledges of more than 1 billion donated doses.
And the United States is leading the world on vaccination donations. We need, as we're doing that, we need other high-income countries to deliver on their own ambitious vaccine donations and pledges. That's why today we're launching the EU-US Vaccine Partnership to work more closely together and with our partners and expanding global vaccinations.
Critics say the world's richest nation can afford to do more. Some question why wealthy nations stockpiled millions of extra vaccine doses and why their citizens are getting booster shots when many around the world have yet to receive a first dose. Tom Hart leads the One Campaign, a health policy advocacy organization.
What they have done very well is they have committed more vaccines to countries that need them. They have committed more funding to institutions to help deliver those vaccines and for the PPE and other responses that are needed. They have supported sharing intellectual property. They have supported increased manufacturing in developing countries. They have used their leadership by example to good effect. And so I'm very proud of what this country has done. And is heads and shoulders above the rest. But to be clear, it is not enough.
Overall, Professor of Medicine Dr. Tyson Bell says Biden gets a good grade for his efforts. But there's plenty of room for improvement next year, he said.
There are a few things that we need to do a better job of. The first is getting low vaccinated communities, encourage them to get vaccinated. And the second is we need to do a better job of getting vaccine available in low and middle income countries. And the growing disparity is now, you know, it's embarrassing at this point. You know, we're 2 years into this and we still have continents like Africa that are at, you know, 10% fully vaccinated. There's no explanation for that and no defense. And then the third, you know, really is laying the groundwork for our future response. Making sure that we have a well-funded public health infrastructure, that we have rapid response capability, that we have the ability to implement testing, and that we can separate the concept of public health from the politics that inevitably gets caught up in.
But he said this virus is a hard worker, and as the new variants have shown, it is adaptable. That means it might be around for a while yet.
I think COVID's going to be with us. What we have to do is get it to a point where it's not overwhelming hospitals. We have low hospitalizations. We have, you know, a manageable amount of deaths year to year. Sad to say it that way, but we need to be able to manage it.
The best way to get there, Bell said, is for everyone to get vaccinated. That, too, is Biden's most oft-repeated piece of advice, and one he very publicly followed in September by getting his third shot. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
President Emmanuel Macron has canceled his trip to Mali to visit French troops. Macron's office attributes the cancellation to the deteriorating health situation in France due to the spread of the Omicron COVID-19 variant. Macron was supposed to meet the Malian leader and visit French forces as they prepare to end their deployment in the region. French military have been deployed in Mali since 2013 to fight against jihadist groups in the country's northern region. And as France reevaluates the future of its military presence, it is worried that its historical security ties to the Sahel are threatened by the Malian government's new deal with the Russian private military company, Wagner Group. For what all this means to the future of the relationship between the two countries, I reached reporter and analyst Catherine Field in Paris. So, Catherine, what was the purpose of this trip and why exactly was it cancelled?
Well, the purpose of the trip was to speak to the authorities in Bamako, to talk to them about the measures which they would put in place to possibly have elections in 2022, and also to pay a visit to French troops that are based now in Gao to do the so-called presidential visit to have Christmas dinner with them. The official reason for him cancelling that is because of the COVID emergency in France. Plus, he thought it would be irresponsible to mingle with French troops in Gao if he was coming directly from France, where there is this an increase in the number of COVID cases.
Now, Catherine, France announced that it's pulling its troops from Mali, essentially bringing an end to Operation Serval. We also learned that the government of Mali is negotiating or has negotiated a contract with the Russian private military company, the Wagner Group. How has France reacted to this news?
This is a red line for France, and this is one of the reasons why President Macron is not going to visit Bamako. The compelling backstory to all of this is that the French have got three red lines with the Malian authorities. One was do not negotiate with jihadists. Now, yes, the official government line is they are not negotiating with the jihadists, but we do hear that local communities are negotiating with them. Another red line was there needed to be an actual date given for elections in Mali. These haven't happened either. There's no date. There's still no possibility of that February 2022 election happening. And the third was the French said there cannot be any connections, any sort of business arrangements, whether official or unofficial, with the Wagner Group. And to back that up, you know, we had the EU foreign ministers just last week announcing new sanctions against 8 individuals involved with the Wagner Group. So for the French, any type of, whether it be subtle or overt with the Wagner Group, was a red line for the French.
Right. And, you know, there has been some tension between Paris and Bamako, a war of words, so to say. Even before the whole Wagner deal, how would you characterize the relationship between these two countries?
At the moment, they're very frosty. Let's have a look at how the French president views it. He views it very much as though this is a government or a regime that he just cannot work with. And he would much rather work with other, what France describes as more reliable partners in the region, such as Ghana or Chad. And so what he's trying to do really is to, if you like, say to the Malian government, okay, well, you can go and deal with the jihadists, you can talk to them, you can talk to the Wagner group, and you cannot hold elections. But don't expect France to step into the void that there is in Mali that has been created because there is no government and no regime on the ground. That's it. And he has been very clear that they are prepared to, if you like, move their bases out of Gao completely and really centralize everything around that major base they have in Niger, in Niamey, which is in far better proximity to that crucial tri-border zone that the French really do want to concentrate on rather than being in northern Mali.
And how has the Malian government reacted to this pushback? And does it seem to you that it's, you know, counterproductive given that terror groups are likely to exploit the vacuum left behind after the departure of the French troops?
Well, one of the things that was quite good for the Malian regime was to the possibility of French President Emmanuel Macron going there this week, because that would have, if you like, shored up the legitimacy of how they're acting at the moment. If they'd got that photo op with President Macron, that would have strengthened them enormously. When it comes to the Wagner group, it's quite a difficult one because on the one hand, yes, everyone recognizes what the Wagner group have been doing in the Central African Republic. There's a lot of criticism. People see what's going on there. But on the other hand, let's not forget there are very close links since the 1960s between Mali and various officials in Moscow. There were very close ties with the Soviet Union when Mali became independent. So those ties have continued. And you know, another issue which came up between Mali and the French government recently was that purchase of helicopters from the Russians just a couple of months ago. That was really something that the French thought, well, you can't be playing on two tables. You can't be saying you want France to underwrite your security, but then at the same time, go behind our backs and go to Russia and buy weapons and air cover from them as well. So for the Malian government, they're saying, well, we've got these relations with Moscow already. We're going to use them as well. And the French are saying quite clearly, you use those and you just see how you get on with Moscow, see how you get on with the Wagner group, and then come back to us in a couple of years and see how you're getting on.
That was reporter and analyst Catherine Field. I reached her in Paris. French troops have left a military base in Timbuktu, Mali, where they were posted since liberating the area from Islamist militants in 2013. French forces have been gradually withdrawing from the region despite ongoing fighting with militants that threatens stability. As Annie Riesenbach reports from Timbuktu, locals are expressing unease about the troops' departure.
On Tuesday, French troops left their military base in Timbuktu as part of a reorganization of Operation Barkhane, announced by French President Emmanuel Macron in June. The Kidal and Tessalit bases were handed over to the Malian army in October and November, respectively. The French troops first set up a base here when the city, along with several others in northern Mali, was liberated in 2013 from Islamist militants. Then French President François Hollande visited Timbuktu the day after its liberation and was welcomed by residents. Salem Oud Alhaj, a historian and a teacher at Timbuktu's famous Ahmed Baba Institute, spoke from a public square by Timbuktu's Sankore Mosque about his experience when the city was liberated.
On en a besoin.
We needed it, he says, and you've seen how the population welcomed them with widespread enthusiasm and unabashed fervor. It's true. I was in Bamako, he says, and it's thanks to the French intervention that I came back to Timbuktu. Since 2013, Mali has weathered two more coups d'etat. Violence and killings have increased and moved further south into the country's center. large protests in Bamako have called for the departure of French troops, with popular sentiment in the capital favoring a potential Russian intervention in Mali. Mohamed El-Bashir, president of Timbuktu's Municipal Youth Council, says that withdrawing Barkhane troops from Timbuktu will make the region less secure. It's not the same feeling here, he says, because the people in Bamako don't live what we're living here in Timbuktu. What we're living here, people in Bamako aren't living. They should come here, and we will go to Bamako. And then they can ask that Barkhane leaves, he says. Then they will understand. That's the reality. France has been gradually retiring its troops from military bases in northern Mali and moving them to Gao, which will now serve as Operation Barkhane's northern base. General Etienne de Peyrou, Barkhane's representative in Mali, says that the handing over of Timbuktu's military base is not an abandonment.
Et puis c'est finalement le but de l'opération Barkhane, c'est de permettre en fait au Mali de prendre en main.
He says this is ultimately the goal of Operation Barkhane, to allow Mali to take its destiny in its hands. After a phase of preparation, after a phase of ramping up, after a training phase, and always in partnership, which will be different, with less of a physical presence, but just as real, he says. At a ceremony on the military base yesterday, the French flag was lowered, the Malian flag raised, and a symbolic key to the base handed over from the French military to the Malian army. Malian military authorities declined to comment to journalists, who were asked to leave the ceremony before their commander spoke to Malian troops. French armored vehicles exited the base for the last time. At the airport, French troops could be seen boarding a military plane headed for Gao. The fate of Timbuktu, once a symbol of Mali's liberation from extremist rule, now rests in the hands of Mali's army. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Timbuktu, Mali.
Voice of America!
Marking International Migrants Day, the United Nations reports hostility and xenophobia are growing against migrants. It warns the stigmatization and marginalization of migrants amid a raging pandemic is putting many lives at risk. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN agencies report one-seventh of the global population, or 1 billion people, are on the move. This number includes a record 281 million international migrants and 84 million people forcibly displaced by conflict, violence, and climate change. Director General of the International Organization for Migration, Antonio Vitorino, says many migrants embark on dangerous, life-threatening journeys in search of better economic opportunities. Others are forced from their homes because of natural and man-made disasters. He says many of these vulnerable people fall into the hands of unscrupulous people smugglers operating along migration routes worldwide. He says COVID-19 has worsened the difficulties migrants encounter.
Beyond the images of closed borders, separated families, and economic instability, the now two-year-old global pandemic has spawned a new wave of anti-migrant sentiment, and the increasing instrumentalization of migrants as tools in state policy. Both are unacceptable.
Instead of being a liability, he underlines the invaluable contributions migrants make across the world. He says migrant workers, nurses, healthcare workers have kept millions of people safe from COVID. He says migrant remittances have provided a lifeline for families made destitute by the pandemic.
The positive social and economic impact in the countries where they reside and the $540 billion remitted last year to communities in lower and middle-income countries are measures of the industry, entrepreneurship, and community from which we all benefit.
And yet he notes too many governments continue to exclude migrants from their pandemic, social, and economic recovery plans because of their legal status. UN and international organizations are appealing to governments to grant migrants access to life-saving COVID-19 vaccines. To do otherwise, they say, would pose a threat to the health of all people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in other news, German Defense Minister Christian Lambrecht says that NATO will discuss Russia's security proposals, but that it will not let Moscow dictate the alliance's military posture. She made the remarks on Sunday during a visit to German troops based in Lithuania to deter a Russian attack. And in Sudan, hundreds of thousands of people marched to the presidential palace in the capital, Khartoum, on Sunday. They were protesting the October 25th military coup. And some protesters managed to reach the gates of the palace, and the protest organizers called on more of them to join a planned sit-in after sundown. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and on YouTube, where you can watch our videos. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. And in Australia, Aboriginal groups have criticized the new law intended to protect cultural heritage in the western part of the country. The legislation was approved following the then legal destruction of sacred 46,000-year-old indigenous caves last year by a mining company. From Sydney, Phil Matzer has more.
The ancient caves at Juukan Gorge in the remote Pilbara region of Western Australia were legally destroyed last year by iron ore miner Rio Tinto, despite opposition from Aboriginal groups. They insisted the site was sacred and should have been protected. Western Australia's heritage laws have now been changed to prevent a similar disaster. A new Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Council will oversee the new system. But there are concerns because the legislation passed Wednesday allows the state government to make a final decision if there's a disagreement between Indigenous leaders and mining companies over whether a particular site should be protected. Hannah McGlade is a human rights lawyer. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the legislation is flawed.
Non-Indigenous mining proponents, developers, have several rights of review throughout the Act if they're aggrieved by various issues. But when it comes to this most important issue for Aboriginal people about wanting to protect a heritage or cultural site, there is no merits review provided. And the Law Society of West Australia, in their recent submission on the bill provided to the government, said they believe this effectively amounts to racial discrimination in law. And it's not about Aboriginal empowerment, it's the minister's decision at the end of the day.
Some Indigenous leaders do support the new law. The Western Australian government has insisted it will protect First Nation landscapes and ancestral remains. State Premier Mark McGowan said in a statement, "The legislation is a historic and significant reform that would support the empowerment of Aboriginal people." He also spoke of the need to find a balance between protecting cultural heritage and realising the economic potential of natural resources. Australia's Indigenous culture has existed for some 65,000 years. Aboriginal people make up about 3% of the national population. Land lies at the heart of their customs and is central to First Nations beliefs around creation. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Let's go to Lebanon, where traffic lights in Beirut have not been functioning for over 3 months now. There has been a shortage of funds to maintain the lights due to the economic crisis in the country. George Eid reports that drivers are facing a great challenge on the busy streets of Lebanon's capital, while experts warn that this will lead to a rise in the number of fatal car accidents.
Most of Beirut's traffic lights have stopped functioning in the past 6 months. Statistics shared by the Lebanese Internal Security Forces with Lebanon's Traffic Management Center show there were 33 fatalities caused by car accidents in the country in June, making a 120% increase compared to April, when traffic lights in Beirut still worked. The outage is mainly because the state was unable to pay Duncan Need, the American-Lebanese joint venture in charge of the upkeep of the traffic lights. Leah Boudoumet, a local journalist who reported on the issue, explains that the problem will not be solved soon.
Currently in Lebanon, no traffic light is working. In Beirut, only we have around 1,000 traffic lights distributed all over the city, and none of them is working. And this is due to a judicial dispute that arose between the Beirut municipality and the Traffic Light Management Authority regarding the return of the park meter, due to the municipality not obtaining its share. As a result of this dispute, the counter stopped working and the return stopped. Consequently, the funds needed for the maintenance were reduced despite the submission of a request for assistance from the Ministry of Finance.
Kamal Ibrahim, a local road safety expert, warns that the outage is jeopardizing the lives of citizens.
He says the outage is caused by the economic crisis in Lebanon. The government does not have the funds to maintain the traffic lights anymore. Driving in Beirut these days is a real adventure. It is really dangerous for people, and no one could predict what happens. We don't see it being solved in the future.
Rita Mubarak, who lives in Beirut, says that her daily trip to work has become a real challenge.
She says, I can't find my way on the roads. There are no traffic lights, and even the police is not there to guide you. It is really hard to drive on Lebanon's roads these days, and the government did not announce a plan to solve the issue yet.
While the economic crisis in Lebanon worsens, hopes to get the traffic lights working again is lost. Meanwhile, many fear that the number of fatal car accidents will continue to rise on the city's busy roads. This is George Aid reporting for VOA from Beirut.
Voice of America!
The women-only farmers market in Diyarbakir, Turkey is a unique place. The market features mostly women, many of them divorced or survivors of abuse, who are looking to create a new life for themselves. However, Turkey's economic troubles are making their lives even more difficult. VOA's Mahmoud Bozaslan has filed this report, narrated by Bezan Hamdad.
As Turkey's economic crisis worsens, merchants at a women-only farmers market in Diyarbakir in the southeast say rising prices are making it difficult to stay in business.
In the past, as far as I know, there was a price increase once or twice a year. Now the prices change every day. The prices of the product we buy change. Every day there is a 1 lira or 50 kroosh increase. The public thinks as if we are doing it.
This farmer's market was established in 2013 in Diyarbakir's Baglar district to provide employment options for women who have been victims of violence or who have little income. It has 212 registered vendors, all of whom are women, making it Turkey's first women-only farmer's market. Many now say the economic troubles are so bad it doesn't even make sense to open their counters.
I have never been in debt, and this year I'm in debt up to my neck. I have to send money I make to my kids as they are university students. We cannot make money. We're going bankrupt more and more. The country is going bankrupt, and we're going bankrupt together.
The value of the Turkish lira has sunk to unprecedented lows in recent months. Resulting inflation has raised the cost of food and almost everything else. The Turkish government's insistence on lowering interest rates is being blamed for the skyrocketing inflation. On December 16, another rate decrease took place. The Turkish currency fell to a new low against the U.S. dollar the next day, prompting the central bank to intervene by selling dollars. Vendors say their sales have plummeted as the value of the lira has dropped and the number of their customers has shrunk.
2 years ago, the prices were very affordable. We were making money. The customers could get what they wanted. It's not the same this year compared to the previous years.
During the economic downturn, some business organizations are asking the government to provide financial support for the women farmers market vendors.
A low or zero interest loan should be given to them to keep the workforce. After all, the women vendors in the market have no capital. There's a shortage of reserves, so they should be supported.
On Thursday, the government announced a 50% increase to minimum wage. However, when converting to U.S. dollars amid Turkish lira's nosedive, the minimum wage earners are making less than last year. The government reiterates that they are determined to end the price fluctuation and will soon announce measures to support businesses. For Mahmoud Bozarslan in Diyarbakir, Turkey, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa News. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7.